great being back here in this beautiful space with all of you. I'm also curious how many of you would consider yourself new to meditation practice or feel very unfamiliar? Okay. So what, do you need a chair, by the way? Does everybody have what they need? There's a chair over there if that's what someone's looking for. And there's one there. Okay. So the way the evening is going to go, as they commonly do here in this space, is we're going to sit together probably for around 20 minutes. I'll guide it so you don't feel so alone. Then we're going to take a break. Let's say a 10-minute break. Realistically, I would think for everyone who wants to go to the bathroom to get to the bathroom, around 10 minutes, maybe even a little more. Then I'll speak about equanimity, which has a lot to do with loving kindness. And we'll have time for questions and then some closing announcements. And then maybe we'll end with like a 1-minute sitting, something like that, and send you on your way into the world. Okay, so I always thought of meditation as a kind of skills training. And I think it really can be seen as that, quite apart, bless you, from any belief system or not really tied even to a particular way of describing it. It's a skills training in concentration, in having our attention be a little more stable. And then in mindfulness, which I'll talk much more about in the course of the evening, and a training in qualities like loving kindness and compassion, which are kind of like the stealth qualities that are being developed. You know, even if they're not talked about, they play a strong role in our actually being able to like accomplish the exercise. So it's not that those three are really divided, although one may be emphasized more than the others in any particular style, but commonly we begin with a kind of foundational exercise, which is choosing an object of awareness, which really could be anything. It could be a sound, a mantra, an image, something happening in your body, loving kindness. Very commonly, for at least part of one's practice, that object, that central object or home base, is the feeling of the breath. It's the actual sensations of the in and out breath. So we choose an object, let's say it's the breath, because that's what I'm going to suggest we use. We rest our attention on that object. Now, right away, that's a challenge, because many people feel, for example, with the breath, that if they get like a death grip on the breath, their minds won't wander, and it'll actually wander more. So the operative word is rest. We rest our attention. And then the next great challenge happens, because usually our attention wanders pretty quickly. It's not likely to be 800 breaths or 900 breaths before your mind wanders. It's much more likely to be one breath, you know, or two breaths, or maybe three breaths. And that's just how our attention is. It tends to be more scattered. We go to distraction easily, and we can talk more about that as well. Then comes the magic moment. However long it's been that you are asleep or your attention is just caught up in some fantasy, there comes a moment when you realize, oh, it's been quite some time since I last felt a breath. And that is considered a very, very significant moment in this exercise, because that's the moment we have the chance to be really different. This is where like the self-compassion sneaks in. Instead of judging yourself and berating yourself and being down on yourself, feeling like a failure, that's where we practice letting go gently and with kindness toward ourselves, returning our attention to the feeling of the breath. It's all an exercise in that return, right? We're practicing coming back and coming back, letting go and coming back. That's why meditation practice is often described as a training in resilience, right? We're learning how to come back with energy, with full-heartedness. It's an exercise in self-compassion. Because more commonly than that, what I just described, we realize we've been distracted, we go into half an hour rant about ourselves and how bad we are, and it's over, right? So not only have we added considerably to the sheer time of the distraction, we're exhausted, right? So we're gonna practice beginning again, over and over again, all right? So let's sit together. If you wanna just sit comfortably as you can. See if your back can be straight without being strained or overarched. You can close your eyes or not, however you feel most at ease. If your eyes are closed and you get really sleepy, it's fine to open your eyes and continue on. So sometimes, even before we get to the breath, we start by listening to sound. The sound of my voice or other sounds. It's a way of relaxing deep inside, allowing our experience to come and go. Of course, we like certain sounds and we don't like others. But we don't have to chase after them to hold on or push away. Just let them come, let them go. And bring your attention to the feeling of your body sitting, whatever sensations you discover. Bring your attention to your hands and see if you can make a leap from the more conceptual level, like go fingers, to the world of direct sensation, picking up pulsing, throbbing, heat, coolness, whatever it might be. You don't want to name these things, but feel them. And then bring your attention to the feeling of your breath. In this system, it's just the normal, natural breath. You don't have to try to make it deeper or different, just however it's appearing. Notice where you tend to feel the breath most strongly. Maybe that's the nostrils or the chest or the abdomen. Bring your attention there and just rest. See if you can feel one breath. Without concern for it's already gone by, without leaning forward for even the very next breath, just this one. And if you like, you can use a quiet mental notation like in, out, or rising, falling to help support the awareness of the breath, but very quiet. So your attention's really going to feeling the breath, one breath at a time. It's just one breath. And if you find your attention has wandered, you get lost in thought, spun out in a fantasy, or you fall asleep, truly don't worry about it. We say the most important moment is the next moment, after you've been gone, after you've been lost. That's the moment. It's the moment of recovery that's most important. We practice letting go, we practice beginning again. Just shepherd your attention back to the feeling of the breath. And if you have to do that a billion times in the next few minutes, that's totally fine. So thank you. We're going to take that promised break. So come back when you can. I'm sure we'll ring a bell at some point. They say you might need the microphone to make the announcement.
Hi, I just quickly wanted to mention something I forgot about when I was talking about the logistics. If anybody has need of them, we have some hearing devices at the right by the registration desk. So if you're having a little trouble hearing the talks, you're welcome to use one of them. Just go back and one of our registrars can and greeters can help you get set up with them. So they are available.
Okay, does anybody want to go get one before I forge ahead? Is it okay? Did you really not hear? Or was that a joke? Okay. So equanimity in, I forget what we called it, challenging times, difficult times. I don't think we need to really talk about the times, do we? You know? Let's talk about equanimity. I'm torn between thinking these are acutely, particularly challenging times, and every time is a challenging time. So I don't know. Maybe we'll discuss that over the weekend. But equanimity is a funny concept for us. It's a funny word. I first began my meditation practice in 1971, in January of 1971, in Bodh Gaya, India. I'd gone to India to learn how to meditate. And my first teacher was S.N. Goenka. And he used to say all of the time, be equanimous, be equanimous, be equanimous. And we used to whisper to one another, is that a word? Like, what does that mean? I never heard that word before. I don't know what it means. And so equanimity is a little strange in whatever form we use the word. It really means balance. To us, it sounds often like indifference, that sullen kind of hostility, like whatever. You know, it often implies removing ourselves from life and even a kind of fear that is covered over by that veneer of coldness. I don't care. Right when we really are just afraid. There's so many ways we take that word or that idea that are misconstrued according to the Buddha's teaching. It means balance. And it's very involved with mindfulness. It's very involved with loving kindness and compassion. It's balance in two different ways. In mindfulness, it's really the balance that leads to wisdom, which I'll talk about in a minute. And in loving kindness, compassion, that consideration, that exploration, it's the balance that's born of wisdom, which we'll also talk about tonight. So it's either the balance that leads to wisdom or the balance that comes from wisdom that we want to add to our compassion, no matter what. So, but even the word balance, I used to find kind of unexciting and unappealing. To me, balance almost meant like dullness or mediocrity. Like, yeah, it's nowhere. It's just balance. It's nowhere. You know, it's nothing. But really, it doesn't mean that at all. It's like a state of harmony where nothing is being added that will stress us out, that will distort our perception, that will confuse us or leave us feeling estranged or alone or cut off, all those ways we can take life that aren't necessarily true but are felt very strongly. So equanimity doesn't mean indifference. It doesn't mean hostility. It doesn't mean withdrawal. It means balance. And so let's look at mindfulness, for example. You know, we did that exercise, which was really a meditation based on concentration. And as many of you know, there are ways that that instruction evolves and elaborates so that we're not only resting our attention on the feeling of the breath. We're looking at physical sensation. We're looking at emotions. We're looking at thoughts. And that's the quality we call mindfulness. So mindfulness means many things. Historically, it's meant many different things. And these days, it's certainly used in many different ways. Of course, when I came back from India in 1974, no one ever used the word mindfulness unless you had gone to India and studied, you know, Buddhism. Whereas now, it's just everywhere. It's so funny. I have a Google alert on the word mindfulness. Somebody suggested I do that, so I have one on, you know, you can get an alert on a figure, public figure, anyone you're really interested in seeing the news about. So I did one on mindfulness and one on compassion. So every day I get news about these things. And I it's like floods of mindfulness news. There's the research, there's this application, there's this clinical extension, there's the backlash, there's the refutation of the study that you just read about yesterday. And now there's the refutation of the study, which is also true. Is so much. So classically, mindfulness means a quality of awareness where our perception of what's happening in the present moment is not distorted. It's not distorted by bias. It's not distorted by old fears. It's not distorted by different habits. The common definition of mindfulness, the common definitions of mindfulness are accurate, but they also, for us, can be misleading because they can sound so passive. It's one of the ways equanimity is held. It's like, all right, I'll just sit here. Do whatever you want. I have equanimity, you know. I'm mindful. So what do we hear? And again, these are accurate definitions, but the words are difficult for us often. We hear mindfulness means being with our experience in the present moment without judgment. What does that mean? Or being, it means accepting our experience as it is. What does that mean? You know, from a certain vantage point, it sounds very passive, very, very complacent. So, for example, we began that meditation with my suggesting, let's sit and listen to sound. So I was teaching somewhere once, and I'd gotten just that far in the instruction. And someone raised their hand and said, what if it's the sound of the smoke alarm I hear going off? Should I sit here mindfully knowing that the smoke alarm is going off? Or should I get up? And I said, I'd get up, you know? Like, but doesn't it sound that way? We're going to accept things the way that they are. Oh, it's the sound of the smoke alarm. I'm accepting it fully, you know? But it's not meant to be inert, and we're not meant to be stupid, you know? It's a connection, a strong connection to what's happening without a kind of immediate, automatic, reflexive veil coming up or addition that comes up that distorts our perception. So a really common example would be if we feel physical pain, bless you, we feel discomfort of some kind, we feel heartache, we feel disappointment. One of the most common habits of mind many people have is to project that into the future. It's not just experiencing it fully with whatever feelings or responses are coming up. It's also, what's it going to feel like in 5 minutes? What's it going to feel like in 10 minutes? What's it going to feel like in 20 minutes? So not only do we have the actual experience, we have the burden of all that anticipation of something that may change anyway. Right, but we've created a world now which is static, which is permanent, which may only get worse. And we're trying to bear that all at once. So of course we feel defeated, we feel overcome. That's not to say the original pain is suddenly delightful, you know, and that we think, oh good, you know, my heart's broken, that's great. It's not like that. Sometimes people take a concept like equanimity or balance to mean we don't feel anything anymore. It's all just kind of gray and bland. And some people yearn for that, actually. Some people, of course, dread that, but it's not what happens anyway. You know, we're not talking about that original pain suddenly feeling like the greatest thing in the world. We're talking about not adding extra, which will make the burden so much worse. So even some of the interesting research, like Richie Davidson at the University of Wisconsin in Madison, who wrote the refutation of the study that I was talking about, who's a really wonderful scientist. He did an experiment. I'm not, you know, totally sure about all the details, but he did an experiment where he had permission to induce physical pain in people somehow. And everyone's in an fMRI machine, so he's looking at their brains and reactivity. And he had a group of people who'd been meditating for 8 weeks and a group of people who'd never meditated before. And what he found, although I've seen other studies that show there's actually a somewhat different response to the pain itself, what he found was that the meditators and the non-meditators pretty well had the same reaction to pain, because pain hurts. And we're human beings. But what happened was that the non-meditators, as soon as the pain was withdrawn, would flip into an anticipatory cycle. When's it coming back? How bad will it be? Maybe it'll be even worse. So they never got a break. They never got to relax. They never got peace. They never got to rest, right? Whereas the meditators would have that response to the pain. The pain was withdrawn. They could relax. They did get a break. They did get peace. That's different. It's a very different way to experience life, isn't it? Which is the whole point. So it's not that, you know, some of these people think, somebody just said to me the other day, I was teaching somewhere, and she said, well, my understanding of Buddhism is that you just stop feeling. You know, you don't have any emotions anymore. And, you know, why do you think that's appealing? And it is appealing for some people, you know, because you have enough pain and you think, well, you know what, I'll give up the pleasure as long as I don't have any more pain. But largely, it's not that appealing and it's not true anyway. You know, we experience, if anything, you know, through the practice of mindfulness, we experience pleasure more completely and more powerfully. Because first of all, we're not so distracted. And we also can see some of the impediments that do arise just from force of habit to the experience of joy and wonder and delight, feeling we don't deserve it, feeling like it's all right, but it should have been that. I mean, almost my favorite story to tell, I'm sure I've told it here year after year, these days is around the time I had gone to Washington, D.C. To teach, and it was what they called cherry blossom season, when, you know, there's this concentrated area of cherry trees that all bloom at once, and it's just this thing, it's cherry blossom season. So this friend had brought me there, and I was looking at all these delicate pink blossoms, and so many of them, and I thought, this is exquisite, it's so beautiful. And then my friend said, oh no, it's past the peak. And right away I thought, oh no, I'm having a bad experience. This just isn't good, right? So there are many, many ways we actually block pleasure and joy and delight. And those are exposed also through the practice of mindfulness. So if anything, we can experience those moments more fully. And we experience pain differently, because pain exists, but what are we adding onto it, perhaps? Another story I often tell, which is really core to a meditative understanding of mindfulness as a skill. I was teaching with my friend, my colleague, Joseph Goldstein, somewhere, and Joseph and I were just sitting in the kitchen having a cup of tea, and somebody came into the kitchen in some distress, and he said to Joseph, I just had this really terrible experience. So Joseph said, well, what happened? And he said, well, I felt all this tension in my jaw, and I realized what an incredibly uptight person I am, and how I always have been and I always will be. And Joseph said, you mean you felt a lot of tension in your jaw? And he said, yes, and I've never been able to get close to people. It's never going to change. Joseph said, you mean you felt a lot of tension in your jaw? And it was really interesting for me, like watching them go back and forth and back and forth. And finally, Joseph said something like, why are you adding a miserable self-image to a painful experience? It's already painful, genuinely so, to feel that tension. But now on top of that, I'm going to be alone for the rest of my life. So that, it's called proliferation, technically. That kind of proliferation is what our minds are habituated to. So what happens when we realize that's beginning? We learn to let go of it and we come back. It doesn't mean we do nothing. It means we have, first of all, a more truthful sense of what our experience actually is, not so distorted by everything we may be adding on to it. And we're not acting automatically, just, you know, in a rush, because we're caught, we're driven by some reaction we're not even sensing half the time. It used to be that my favorite definition of mindfulness pretty well came from this article I'd read in the New York Times many years ago. This is when the kind of movement to bring mindfulness into schools was really just beginning. And it was a pilot program in this fourth grade classroom in Oakland. So there was an article in the New York Times about it, and there were two quotes that I really liked a lot from the article. One was from one of the researchers who said something like, all day long we tell kids to pay attention, but we never teach them how. And then they asked one of the kids, so this is a fourth grade classroom, right? So he's like, let's say 9 or 10 years old. They said to him, what is mindfulness? What is mindfulness? And he said, mindfulness means not hitting someone in the mouth. That's what mindfulness means. And I thought, that is a great definition of mindfulness. Really, it is. Because what does it imply? It implies you know you're feeling angry when you're starting to feel angry. You're that much in touch with what's going on. Not after you've sent the email. Not after you've lashed out. Not after you've hit someone in the mouth. But as it's beginning. It also implies a certain balanced relationship to that anger. Because if you hate what you're feeling and you're ashamed of it and you try to deny it, you try to stuff it down, you just get tighter and tighter and tighter till you explode. On the other hand, if you just fall into, you get overwhelmed by, defined by everything that comes your way. You lose that sense of space. You lose that sense of centeredness. You're likely to hit a lot of people in the mouth because life can be really annoying, right? So to find that place in the middle where we're not overcome by what's going on and we're also not fighting it. That's another way mindfulness is defined, that place in the middle. We can connect completely to what's happening without being overwhelmed by it and without pushing it away. And that gives us room. That is the opportunity for options to arise, creativity to arise, possibilities to arise. Maybe in that space that gets created, you think, you know what? Hit someone in the mouth last week, didn't work out that well. Maybe I'll try this instead. Or I have these friends, their organization's called the Holistic Life Foundation. These great, great guys. They teach in the inner city in Baltimore schools yoga and meditation. And they have for years now. And they're fantastic people. And their program is really great. There was some video that actually really did go viral, you know, with millions and millions of hits about one school is using these mindfulness sessions instead of detention. So they told me this story about this little girl, maybe I'll say she was like 7 or 8 years old, something like that. And she was really poor and her clothes were really tattered and the kids used to tease her and bully her a lot. And she used to fight back and she was always getting into trouble because of the fighting. And they taught her meditation. They said one day they walked into like the gym or a classroom or something like that. And she was holding up this other kid by the neck against the wall. And then she said to the kid, "You're just lucky I know how to meditate." And she dropped her and then went and sat, you know, and like composed herself. You know, so it's not that you become inert and you think, oh, smoke alarm, you know. You can respond, you can take action, you can do things. But it doesn't have to be so driven, right? We have some space, we have some possibilities that arise. So that's really, it's the equanimity part that's hidden in the mindfulness. Mindfulness doesn't just mean you know something's going on with like loathing, you know, like, oh, there's anger arising, I hate myself, right, for that. But it's knowing in a different way with balance so that we can understand so much more fully what our experience is. And doesn't that make sense? Like, something arises and you're fighting it right away, you're not going to understand it more deeply. And at the same time, if it just sweeps over you and there's no space, you're also not going to understand it so much. Understanding doesn't mean like ordinary understanding, like why in the world is this here when I've been meditating for all these years, you know, but like what is this? What is the nature of this? We learn so much about our own experience. We see so many emotions folded into other emotions. We see how much things change all the time, even though we can so easily imagine them to be permanent. We see how we're connected to one another when maybe we have historically felt very alone or cut off. We see, oh, look at that truth. Our lives are actually intertwined. They're interdependent. So it's the balance in the mindfulness that allows us to be with that whole range of experience, to understand it so much more deeply. And equanimity, so that's the balance that leads to wisdom. Equanimity plays a big role in the unfolding of qualities like loving kindness or compassion in our lives. Loving kindness, the literal translation of the word metta, M-E-T-T-A, which is loving kindness most commonly, is friendship. I tend to describe it as connection for a whole variety of different reasons. Metta or loving kindness doesn't mean you necessarily like somebody. Doesn't necessarily mean you're going to spend any time with them. But within one's heart, there's a deep recognition that our lives have something to do with one another. That we really do live in an interdependent universe. Compassion is almost like a sister quality to that. They say that one of the springboards for having loving kindness emerge in our lives is to recognize that everybody actually wants to be happy. We all actually do want to be happy, not just superficial happiness, but a deep a sense of belonging somewhere. We want a sense of having a home somewhere in this body, in this mind, with one another on this earth, somewhere. We want to be a part of something greater than our usually limited sense of self. And we are fed so many myths and so many just downright lies about where happiness is to be found. And it takes a lot to step away from all that and to question and to really want to see for ourselves, given the just the barrage, you know, of all of that conditioning. So I'm also fond of this story where I kind of temporarily sort of ruined this young woman's life because I was co-teaching this six-day retreat, seminar, sort of. And the first night I was talking about kind of that ludicrous phrase, it's a dog-eat-dog world. It's a dog-eat-dog world. And, you know, and yet that's the very conditioning many of us have, you know. Don't help anybody else because they're not going to help you. And you're on your own and you've got to fight for everything and it doesn't matter who you have to step on your way up because the most important thing is that kind of success. Or, you know, a lot of us do have that conditioning in one form or another. And so this young woman came up to the microphone and she said, I never knew the phrase was, it's a dog-eat-dog world. I always thought the phrase was, it's a doggy-dog world. Like puppies and meadows jumping up and down, you know. It's a doggy-dog world, D-O-G-G-Y-D-O-G. So 6 days went by, and, you know, the seminar unfolded, and then the last day is closing circle, and she got up in front of the microphone, and she said, I refuse to live in a dog-eat-dog world. I'm going to live in a doggy-dog world, you know, so. But, you know, we do get a chance to look at all that conditioning and how apart we might feel and we've been trained to feel and the things we've been taught, you know, if only I had a bigger apartment, then I would be happy. If only I had whatever, then I would be happy. We get to look, is that really true? Maybe I could be happy now, you know. What about connection? What about feeling a part of things? What about generosity? You know, many of us, what are we taught strength is? You know, many of us are taught it's vengefulness and, you know, never, ever, ever, ever let them get away with it. However, whatever form that might take. But, you know, like by the billionth hour you've spent thinking about somebody's faults again and again, and again, and again, and again, never even noticing a new fault, but just again, and again, the same list. As one friend of mine said, I think from his AA experience, he said, having obsessed quite a lot about somebody in just that way, he said, I've let him live rent-free in my brain for far too long. You know? Now, how happy is that, really? Whatever we've been told about that state of obsession is not that happy when we take a look. Or what are we taught about generosity? What are we talk about? What are we taught about compassion itself? You know, that's for stupid people, or, you know, that's a weakness, or that's sentimental, or you're going to lose your edge, you're going to lose all intensity, you're going to lose all forcefulness. You know, it's really... I mean, probably the best exemplar of that is Dan Harris, who is a friend. He's an ABC News anchor, and many of you probably read his, or perhaps have read his book, his first book, 10% Happier. He has an app called 10% Happier, which many of us are on, who, when he began his meditation practice, he began... because he was very, it was a number of reasons. You know, he had a panic attack on the air, which is really a really funny recording, which I've seen like a million times. We sort of traveled together. We each had a book come out at the same time for a while. So I saw that a lot. He was messed up in a lot of ways, and he was also very intrigued by the science. He was very reassured by the science around mindfulness, but loving kindness was that was for stupid people. And to his enormous chagrin, as he describes in the book, he did a retreat with Joseph, and the kind of major experience he had during the retreat was doing loving kindness practice, which he couldn't believe. So he'd say he was reading my first book, which was called Loving Kindness, on the New York City subway, and he was so embarrassed to be seen reading a book called Loving Kindness that he used to cover the cover. And he himself is writing a book on kindness right now. I'm so pleased. He told me he would cover the cover. So then I took a look at, some of you have had me sign them since I've been here. I took a look at the cover, and that print is kind of big. And I realized he wasn't just covering it with his fingers. He was covering the cover. It was like it was pornography or something. And I thought, that's so interesting. You know, like most people would ride on the subway reading a book called, like, Smash Them to Smithereens or something. And, like, they'd be fine. They wouldn't think anything of it, you know. But loving kindness, it's like, whoa, you know. So we're taught many things, and it takes a lot to step away from that and to search, where is happiness truly? So that's a lot of the basis of loving kindness, realizing we're all kind of in that predicament. Compassion is a quality, is sometimes defined as the trembling or the quivering of the heart in response to seeing pain or suffering. So the universal there is not so much that everybody wants to be happy, but more that we're all so vulnerable. Not that everybody, by any means, has the same measure of pain or suffering in their life, but that vulnerability is really shared. It's like, life's pretty unsteady. It's moving all the time. You might be going along pretty confident in a certain course of events. You get one phone call, you have a different life. And that is true for everybody. So compassion, you know, sometimes people think of compassion as a kind of hierarchical state or a very stratified state. Like I, whose life is so perfect way over here, am looking at you way down there whose life has fallen apart because mine never, ever, ever could. Well, guess what? Maybe not in the same way, but lives fall apart. Because it's always moving, and not just in a kind of negative direction, you know. Opportunities arise, change comes. All kinds of things abound. It's the insecurity of it that we share. And so compassion is much more kind of equal state, right? It's not so much about everybody wanting happiness, but the vulnerability. So those two qualities are at the core of kind of the evolution of the heart within the Buddha's teaching. And then there's sympathetic joy, which is having happiness for others, for their happiness, rather than feeling so jealous or envious when we hear about or witness someone else's happiness. It's actually being happy for them. But here, too, it's like the secret ingredient is equanimity. In this case, it's the balance born of wisdom that we are bringing to the situation. Now, compassion can be defined as the trembling or the quivering of the heart in response to seeing pain or suffering. So it's a movement of the heart. And it's a movement toward to see if we can be of help. It's not a movement into to burn up ourselves. It's a movement toward to see if we can be of help. That's one of the ways compassion is described that's different than being overcome, burning out, feeling shattered by witnessing pain. Because in all of those states, they're natural. They seem inevitable in some ways. But if that's the main arena we're operating within, we don't have the energy to move toward to see if we can be of help. We're exhausted, right? We're overcome. It's too hard. And so there's balance implied in there, right? To be able to feel, be sensitive to, be aware of someone's pain, to have compassion for them and compassion for ourselves at the same time. Or to bring wisdom into that action, you know, we care about somebody, we feel enormously for their predicament, and we maybe have to realize it's not up to me. I'm sadly not in control of this universe, where I can just say, poof, you know, do this. And thus far as I know, no one has invented the chip we can implant in someone else's brain with our having the remote control. Like, cheer up. You know, it's too bad, really. You know, it's not just nosiness, you know, or needing to be in control, but really. I once said, trying to think if it was actually in this room or not, or in Seattle, and I once said, you know, I really believe if I were in control of the universe, it would be a lot better universe. And somebody said, are you sure? For some reason, I think it was in Seattle. Somebody said, are you sure? And I thought about it, and I said, I am really sure. You know, like, and increasingly in challenging times, I'm really sure. But I'm not in control. That doesn't mean there's nothing I can do or there's nothing I should be doing. But that idea of like kind of domination, like I can just say, poof, it's up to me, you know, completely to change someone's brain, to change their feeling. It's not like that. Life just isn't like that. So there's a great poignancy also in compassion as we recognize I will do everything I can and. Or maybe it's one of the features of equanimity, which we'll talk about during the weekend, is a kind of big picture view. You know, so many times we do something, trying to make a difference, and we get very impatient, like, didn't bear fruit right away. I didn't see results right away. And that doesn't mean there are no results. So many times we do something, and it really is like planting a seed. It's going to take some time, and all these other factors might have to align. And sometimes, many times, we don't even know, right, what happened. Sometimes we do know, because somebody comes back even years later and says something like, oh, you know, you gave me that book, and it really was meaningless to me, in all honesty, but now, all these years later, my life is different. And I picked up the book, and it was perfect. You know, when we're lucky, we know. Sometimes we don't know. But if we don't do what we need to do, like planting the seeds, certainly nothing will happen. Right? And so equanimity is the balance born of wisdom. It's perspective. I may not see the results today. Or I did the best I could. That's all I can do for now. I'm not in control of this universe, which, oddly enough, is not a discouraging statement. It doesn't lead to apathy. It doesn't lead to withdrawing. It doesn't lead to giving up. I think, certainly as I've looked at situations where I have given up and I've fallen into that kind of despair, really, it's more from the feeling that, it's more from the impatience, it's from the expectation, it's from the demand that I be in control, only to find again and again that I'm not. It's not from wisdom, which opens up kind of the playing field right away. So we're operating more from perspective, from that sense of space. What we see in front of us may not be the end of the story, it's just what we see in front of us. And we have to do what we can do. So it's very powerful, actually, to look at relationships of different kinds, especially when it involves something like the qualities of compassion or loving kindness. And take a look. What inhibits that, really? Does wisdom ever inhibit it or thwart it or distort it? what enhances it? What really helps us move forward and grow and be there and hang in there in circumstances that aren't so gratifying right away? And you will see the force of equanimity. What does it mean to have loving kindness for someone or compassion for someone? And, you know, disagree so strongly. Bless you that you know that you're going to fight, or you're going to take a stand, or you're not going to let go of your sense of right and wrong or principle, even as you are developing loving kindness. Remember, loving kindness doesn't mean you like somebody or you approve of them. It means recognizing our lives are intertwined in some way. Compassion doesn't mean, may you win because you want it so badly, even though it'll destroy the neighborhood and half the earth, you know, whatever. It's not like that. You're not losing intelligence. Equanimity is the voice of wisdom that has to do with big picture perspective, openness, spaciousness. And you realize, oh, you know what? I can be generating greater and greater compassion for someone and not agree with them at all and not lose energy for the effort that I'm making. You know, so none of these are easy questions. And we look at them not analytically even, but through embodied experience. That's why it's a practice. You know, if we do loving kindness practice, always equanimity is going along for the ride. Otherwise, it wouldn't be loving kindness. Another way of seeing it is that the first three qualities in this bundle, which are loving kindness, compassion, and sympathetic joy in the happiness of others, are all qualities of generosity. They're giving, right? They may not be like material generosity, but we tend to look at material generosity as an example, because it's so concrete. So we know there are many, many ways of giving something. You can give something as a freely given gift. You know, may you enjoy it. We can give something and kind of like, thank me, would you? Thank me again. Thank me louder. We can give something as a medium of exchange. Well, I see you have that, you know, so I'll just give you this and maybe you'll give me that. We can give something because we just gave a lecture on generosity and all these people are watching and we want to appear like a certain kind of person. We couldn't care less if you enjoyed it or not, you know, but... or we might even give something because we don't like the person and somehow... I don't really see a potentially displeasing object here, but, you know, maybe we give somebody a book and we think, you know, page 5 is going to upset you. Have a book. Right? And it looks exactly the same on the surface from any other kind of giving, but it's coming from a certain kind of place inside. That's why part of mindfulness is actually looking at our motivations or our intentions behind action. And a big part of loving kindness is understanding it as a force of generosity. It may not be material generosity, but you know, we smile at somebody, we listen to them when we're kind of busy, or, you know, we stop being so distracted and we really pay attention when someone's talking instead of thinking about the email we need to send and all of that. That's all generosity of the spirit. Or somebody seems to be struggling. Maybe they're not struggling with something that we feel a struggle about, but we can sense, oh, you know, somebody told me a very... touching story about their mother getting older, and when she had been younger, she was like an incredibly adventurous person. She traveled the world before he did and, you know, did all these things. But as she got older, in terms of physical risk, you know, her world got smaller and she got more and more afraid. And he said they were taking a walk one day, he and his mother, and they came upon like the slightest of inclines. And she said, I can't do it. you know, I can't do it. And first he was very judgmental and he was very harsh. And then he realized, you know, for her, it's not the slightest of inclines. That looks like Mount Everest to her. You know, pay attention. And in fact, that's the birth of compassion, when we realize, you know, it's not my, everyone's not subscribing to the same design, you know, and perception. You know, that's hard for some people. That's kind of scary. You know, and so we have enough balance to accept that. Oh, yeah, people are responding differently because they're coming from different places. You can have compassion for somebody, you know, who seems to be having a difficult situation. It's equanimity that actually allows these things to be freely given gifts without all the strings attached, without needing to be noticed, without needing to be praised for our action, without needing it to succeed. Like, mom, get over it. Right? So the freeing quality comes from the equanimity. It comes from balance. It comes from wisdom. I don't think there's ever a time we don't want wisdom in the picture. And why would we want it not to be there? You know, why would we want to be lost and confused and just subject to our conditioning without being able to take a look at it, or forgetting what we learn, you know, is really important to us? And why? So to have these qualities be like a freely given gift, we need the wisdom, which means we need equanimity. And so that's the cultivation. We cultivate equanimity through mindfulness, through letting go and beginning again, through paying attention differently. When we see our minds go off on that arc of anxiety, you know, like, and next year it's going to hurt even worse, you know, say, let's reel it back, you know. We didn't need to proliferate quite that much. This is what's happening right now. And we cultivate equanimity relationally in terms of loving kindness practice. Every time we do loving kindness practice, because it's in there, it's like, as we'll do over the weekend, you know, when you do loving kindness practice, rather than resting your attention on the feeling of the breath, you rest your attention on the silent repetition of certain phrases, like, may you be happy, may you be peaceful. And as one friend of mine said, without the equanimity, it becomes metta, or loving kindness with an edge. Like, may you be happy by Tuesday. I think I can give you till Tuesday. Right now you're at the top of my list of people for me to make happy, but you know, you're not going to be on the top of the list forever, so I'd say hurry up. You have till Tuesday. And speaking of lists, here's your list of everything you need to change in order to be happy according to my lights, you know. That's metta with an edge. It's not exactly a freely given gift. You know, so even just doing that practice, inevitably we're cultivating some equanimity. And then we also bring it in consciously in the form of wisdom. We remind ourselves, I will do everything I can, and it's not my universe to control. Or we remind ourselves about the nature of generosity and the different flavors and aspects it can take, and that we don't need to fall into those old patterns and so on. So equanimity, like all these qualities, is something we cultivate, we develop, we grow, so that it can enrich both our seeking wisdom and our expression of wisdom in all of these aspects of our life. Okay, do you have questions or comments? I'm going to ask you to try to speak loudly, and I'll try to repeat, and briefly, so I can try to repeat. Okay. Oh.
Public schools.
How would I suggest bringing meditation and mindfulness into the classroom? I would go to one of the, I don't know really what exists in Seattle so much, but by now there are many training programs, there are many experienced people in doing that, you know. And I would try to get a sense of best practices, because schools are a pretty unique, public schools are a pretty unique arena in that, you don't just have the people you're teaching, which may be school teachers or children or young adults. You have parents who have very strong views often. And so, it needs to be completely secular. There's certain kinds of language that seems to be appropriate and other kinds of language that's a little riskier and that you probably don't want to go to. So in New York, there are things like the Lineage Project. In California, there's Mindful Schools. And also in the East Coast, there's IBME, which is more teenagers. And I mean, there's so many, and I would, and they're good. They're very good in what they do. And I would really just try to pick up what they've learned. Yeah.
I'm not sure if this is a fully formed question, but thinking about mindfulness in challenging times, when we think about news, political things, climate change, Supreme Court, all those things, we get fear thinking into the future, right? And you were talking about that place of how you deal with coming about that loss.
Mm-hmm. Sure. So speaking of today, today's kind of news, not just today, but the kinds of things we're hearing and we're facing and how likely it is that we'll get afraid and how can we sort of be with those feelings without leaning so much into the future. I think it's actually that skill. But I would never encourage someone not to feel what they feel. You know, to say that it's wrong to feel fear, for example. It's wrong to feel anger. I don't really think that's true. The gap we're looking for is between what we're feeling and how we're acting. The first gap we're looking for. Because we feel what we feel. And if anything, there's enormous strength in being able to sit with very painful feelings, which is not a skill most of us are taught in our life. And the culture doesn't promote it. Especially American culture, the first moment you're bored or frightened or something, it's like, buy something, and so it takes a lot just to sit and in a loving way toward yourself, be with the feelings. And if you can do that, I think you understand them much more and you're not so driven. So for example, as I've said often, I spent a lot of time looking at my own fear. And that means, first of all, trying to let go of the add-ons. This shouldn't be here anymore. I've been meditating for so long. I spent all that money in therapy. Why is this still here? This has been here for so long. I'm such a frightened person. I always will be. So again, it's avoiding, both those extremes. And just being with it. And then we see, one of the things I've seen looking at my fear is that unlike kind of the world's pronouncement that we're afraid of the unknown, I see I'm afraid when I think I do know. And it's going to be really bad. And it's the stories I tell myself that really frighten me. And if even in the midst of that kind of arc of anxiety, if I could remind myself, you know what, you actually don't know. Then I feel relief, and I feel space. And that was an important thing for me to understand about my own fear, because of course it's not just sitting in a funny posture that I feel afraid. And that's useful. And so anger is the same thing. In Tibetan Buddhism, they say anger is that which we pick up when we feel weak, because we think it's going to make us strong. And so almost always if you sit and you look at your anger, you will find a sense of helplessness. So there is a strength in the anger. It's energized, right? It's kind of awakening in that way. But what are the consequences of being lost in anger? We can also take a look at that. And usually there are many. One of the characteristics, and I don't mean feeling the anger, I mean being lost in the anger. One of the characteristics of really being overcome by anger usually is tunnel vision. Or if you think about the last time you were really, really angry at yourself, just bring it back for a moment. it's not really a time where you think, you know what, I said that stupid thing, but I did five great things that same morning. Those five great things, they're gone, right? So we're so socked in there that we're losing a lot of information. We're losing a big sense of possibility. I tell this story too sometimes about, it was in like the olden days of email, which is such a funny thing to say. But those days when like you'd hear that sound, like you've got mail and you'd be so excited. Like, wow, I have mail. It's not like, oh God, another email. You know, but it was so exciting. So I was at home in Barre, Mass, working at my desktop, and I heard that sound. I got so excited. So I'd gotten an email from somebody who said, I don't understand what the problem is with anger. So I wrote back to him, and again, I'm not talking about what we're feeling. I'm talking about being overwhelmed by it and having it guide us into choices and actions and so on. So I wrote back to him, and I said, well, one of the problems when we're lost in anger is that we tend to just put people in a box. Then I got offline, and I was working on some project, and something went terribly wrong in the relationship between my computer and my printer, and I got really angry. So the first person I was really angry at was, this is long before we had the phrase IT. We used to call him our computer assistant, who was on vacation in Hawaii. I was furious. Like, you are never here when I need you. Totally forgetting in that moment, the reason he was on vacation was because I thought he needed a vacation. And the reason he was in Hawaii was because you used to have to do this. So I went down to the airport and used my frequent flyer miles to get him a ticket to Hawaii. It was like gone, right? And the second person I was really angry at was myself. I was down on my hands and knees, like pulling out plugs and putting in other plugs and ranting at myself. Why can't you be the kind of person who can fix this thing? You know, why can't you do anything? You don't know how to do these things. Let me tell you, I fixed it. But I hardly even took a moment to appreciate, hey, you fixed it. So I got back on my chair and I was doing my thing and I heard that sound again, the magic sound. So I went to the email and there was the original correspondent who said, I don't understand what you mean by saying when we get lost in anger, we just put people in a box. So I wrote to him and I said, well, this is what just happened. You know, I put this guy in a box. You are never there when I need you. Was that true? Maybe not. I put myself in a box. You can't fix anything. That wasn't true either. Right? So we can get lost in that very circumscribed world. And it will actually increase our sense of helplessness in the end. Because we're just so caught in that very tight, little, narrow, rigid thing. So one of the tasks almost is to capture the energy of it so we're not so kind of complacent without getting caught in the tunnel vision of it, you know? But we can only do that by being able to pay attention to it and hang in there with it. And then I always, you know, am intrigued by the power of loving kindness practice because it's not what we fear it will be, which is just being squishy. You know, or giving in or something like that. To actually recognize how connected our lives are, no matter who we are, I think is a very powerful thing.
Yeah. What do you think of that? I can't tell if I should be encouraged or really afraid.
The question was about Headspace, which is one, it's probably the most famous app for meditation instruction, applying to the FDA to be a clinical intervention, basically. And I don't know what the entity, you know, what they're supposedly intervening in, because I have
some sort of like your physician would prescribe you to go do this.
Right, but I don't know why, if it was anxiety or depression or whatever. Yeah, I think it's great.
Okay.
I had a very classical education in Buddhism, as should be obvious, perhaps. Certainly would be by Sunday afternoon. But I think all this is wonderful. Not all of it. I think a lot of it is wonderful. And when Jon Kabat-Zinn began mindfulness-based stress reduction, it was in Worcester, Mass., which is very close to Barre, Mass., where the Insight Meditation Society is, which Joseph, Jack, and I began in 1976. And I was very intrigued by, I thought, what is Jon up to? So sometimes we say I was his first intern. I went over there twice a week to see what was going on. And all of his first people practicing mindfulness-based stress reduction, or, you know, body scan, eating a raisin, the whole thing, were patients who'd been sent by their doctors who did not know what to do for them anymore. So everybody was ill. Insurance was covering it. And people were highly, highly motivated because they were suffering so much. And it was really fascinating, you know, and I saw tremendous changes for people. You know, people who'd had migraines for 25 years, people who had, whose life was really held back because of some physical ailment or, you know, it was great. But that's not to say that, I don't know really about the app, you know, or that it's the perfect answer. I'm very concerned about people not having a chance to ask questions because we tend to go into meditation, like into anything, with a tremendous amount of assumption. So I would say probably one of the most common response, well, in the old days, like in 1974 and onwards in that era, when I'd be at a party or some social situation, and, you know, also interesting to me, we tend to meet someone and we don't say, what makes you happy? We say, what do you do? Right? So people would say, what do you do? So I'd say, I teach meditation. And often they would kind of go, oh, that's a little weird. Or, you know, occasionally somebody would say to me, did you meet the Beatles when you were over there? And I'd say, no, they went when I was in high school. And anyways, different practice. But anyway. And these days, you know, after all the research and the publicity and everything, there are a few responses that are very, very common. One is, I'm so stressed out, I could use some of that. One is, my partner should really meet you. They're really stressed out. And a very common response is, I tried that once, I failed at it. And if there's time and I say, what makes you think you failed at it? People say, I couldn't make my mind blank. I couldn't get all thoughts out of my head. I couldn't keep the sleepiness from coming. I couldn't keep anxiety from arising. And we believe completely that you cannot fail at this. You can't, because you can't have the wrong experience. The point is not what's arising. The point is how we are with what's arising. You know, how much presence, how much balance, how much kindness are we bringing to that anxiety, to that sadness, to that sleepiness, to that knee pain? That's the question, and it's very hard to believe, but it's true. And, you know, in these days, there's also a certain kind of social pressure. You know, it's like if you left here and you probably won't go to dinner because you're not in New York, but, you know, in New York, you'd be going to dinner tonight, and you ran into a friend, and they said, let's say you never meditated before or it wasn't very common for you, and they said, how was it? We would all like to say, you know, well, first, it's a little bit of struggle at first, but then, I don't know, it was like this clarity came over me, and it was just like filled with light, and I was so peaceful. It was like this unfathomable peace, and then right around the edges of the peace was bliss, and then it was just like bliss and peace and bliss and peace. We don't want to say, well, I was grumpy, you know, and then I was bored, and then I was sleepy, but in all honesty, that it's not good and bad. Because if you're with that sleepiness and that grumpiness and that boredom with presence and balance and kindness, that is good meditation. You know, so I don't know any intervention, you know, has to deal with people's assumptions, because we all bring them into the process, and I don't know how that one does. I mean, I've seen it, you know, it's got great animations and stuff like that, but I've never really used it. I did use 10% Happier before I was ever on it. The first teacher was Joseph, and it was he was the only teacher for a long time. Dan would be interviewing and stuff like that, but he's, you know, he's not a teacher, so I, out of solidarity, I bought it, you know. And then I got a coach, I got assigned, you only had to give your first name, so I gave my first name, and I got a coach assigned to me. He was a really sweet guy who said, "May I ask, is this your first time meditating?" So I wrote back and I said, "Well, no, actually, I've been meditating for a long time." And he wrote back and he said, "Well, I'm a new meditator, but I want you to know." And they had a lineup of really senior students, you know, long experience in meditation. He said, "I have a lot of people I can refer your question to." And, you know, so I wrote back and I said, "Thank you so much. I'm really happy to hear that." And then, you know, time went on, and every once in a while he'd write and said, "Are you sitting?" And I'd write back and say, "Yes, I'm sitting. It's fine." And then Joseph finally told him it was me. Because you know, so. That was the end of that. But it was important, you know, that. And so I'm glad, though. I mean, I think, you know, I'd be happy if, you know, people on Medicare could meditate for nothing, and you know, people with all kinds of situations would have help in doing that. So may it succeed. Yes.
I can't help but think of how Herbert Benson in Boston first started doing meditators.
So the comment was about Herbert Benson, who was a real pioneer in mind-body medicine and teaching meditation in this country, and it was so controversial and quite unpopular. It's true. Like, I don't know about your situation, how long, you know, many of you may have been meditating, your professors, but, you know, I was at teaching, and the last question after a week, somebody raised their hand, and she was a psychotherapist in Boston. And she said, "I'm a psychotherapist in Boston, and the pressure to use mindfulness in my practice is so strong." And I said, "Really? You know, like, that's really funny." And then the next day, I just happened to be in a meeting, which included a few psychiatrists who were older than she, were my age, and I brought it up, and they said, "Oh, I remember when it was a secret. Like, you could never disclose that. You know, you just couldn't tell anyone you were a meditator." It's just like, so here we are. We're so flagrant now. We're everywhere. Okay, anybody in the side of the room? Interesting air conditioning system. Sometimes it's on and sometimes it's off. Okay, anybody else? Yes. Yeah. Uh-huh. Okay, so the question was about kind of the psychological damage that can sometimes come from meditation practice. I don't know that I say that my experience was so much psychological damage, but certainly there can be really a feeling of overwhelm. There can be some really rough times, and if you know you have a history of trauma, for example, and either a kind of complex trauma or recent trauma, it's really good to have a teacher, you know, because there's so many forms and there's so many styles, and we get caught. You know, one of the assumptions people make is that it has to look a certain way. You know, you've got to sit for an hour, for example. You've got to sit with your eyes closed. You've got to sit is even an assumption. You know, there's walking meditation, there's eating meditation, there's a lot of active meditations. And they would be much better in a lot of ways, depending on one's history. And it's not right and wrong, and it's not superior and inferior. It's just what's appropriate. Another thing about balance, and the very word balance, is that it's not static. You know, and it looks different for everybody, and it looks different for any of us at different times. So, you know, and something we'll talk about over the weekend is like there's a lot of emphasis on what the Buddha called right effort, you know, which means not too much and not too little. And that's hard to hit. And when you hit it, doesn't mean that's the same tomorrow. You know, there's a story in the texts about a monk, a man who became a monk. And before he became a monk, he was a lute player. Right, so it's a stringed instrument, and apparently as a monk, he was trying way too hard, and he was way too forceful and pushy in his sitting and his practice, and the Buddha came up to him and said something like, oh, back when you were a lute player, what was it like if you tied the string too tight? And he said, oh, it made the wrong sound, and what was it like when you tied the string too loose? And he said, oh, it made the wrong sound, so... In that particular moment, he was tying the string too tight. And, you know, for all we hear about effort and putting your heart into it and that kind of intensity, there's such a thing as tying the string too tight, you know? And a teacher would probably say, relax, or... I mean, they don't usually say that to me, but no, theoretically, no, they do. Not to me, though. You know, I've had friends where the teacher said, well, don't practice formally at all. You know, be aware every time your hands are in water. You know, go out and look at the sky. Not, you know, like, flake off, you know, and waste the time, but it's a whole other form than what we imagine. So that might be really wise. And at the very least, be in a situation where you can ask questions, because I think largely the things we assume... Are pretty self-punishing. And it would take some skillful voice to say, open your eyes, get up, go look at the sky, do some loving kindness. Or don't sit right now, go help somebody else, which I've also heard. Because everything will come up, you know, like these treasures and extraordinary experiences and some very, very difficult things to face. It'll happen. So depending on the context, you know, like intensive retreat, which certainly if you come to Barry, if you come to the Insight Meditation Society, it's silent, it's intense, it's like a real immersion experience. You talk to the teacher, but you don't talk to anybody else. And there are times in anyone's life where it's just not the right thing. And there's nothing shameful about that, you know, it's just like, it's too intense. There are other times when it's like you're so relieved, I don't have to talk to anybody. You know, how great is this? And you just feel the freedom of just being yourself, and it's so great. So it just depends. But if you decide that, and a lot of that, those studies are, have come from more intense retreats, you know. If you decide that's not the form, that's fine, you know. You can pursue meditation, you know, lots and lots of other ways. And they're very authentic and important. Yeah. From different what? From the jhanas? when I said earlier that I saw meditation as a skills training, and one of those skills was concentration. Mostly, as we teach and as I was taught, we practice concentration only to a certain level, like that single point, you know, just the breath, for example. And then we open up the field of awareness so that we're watching a lot of different experiences come and go, and it's more about insight, like, look how much this changes and things like that. But you can pursue just concentration if you want. The teaching is that if you pursue just that kind of return and gathering and coming back, like if you're practicing concentration on the breath, it doesn't matter what else comes up, you know, this dazzling thought or this horrible emotion, just like, doesn't matter, it's not the breath, right? So we're always just letting go and coming back and letting go and coming back. That path is a path of power, because it's like a huge amount of energy we are gathering together that could be available to us, but is not. And if you take that to a certain extent, then they say you experience states called jhanas, or sometimes it's translated as trance, which is a little weird, but it's states of absorption, you know, where you're so concentrated that you kind of move to another. It's like an alternate state of consciousness. And, you know, some schools, like where I practiced in Burma, would say that that's not a small accomplishment. Other teachers feel it's more available. So, you know, I can't speak to that. But really, you would use metta for the experience of the jhana. It's not like you would be practicing metta in the jhana. You would use it as a form of concentration to achieve these states of consciousness, which are all about bliss and peace, and, you know, and so on. So my particular teachers, that particular school, they tended to not really emphasize the jhanas, even though it's in the texts, and some schools do. Clearly, we need some amount of concentration, or something comes up and we're just lost in it all the time. So there's a certain amount of concentration they were urging us to develop, but because they considered the jhanic states more rarefied, not to that extent, you know, and they said you didn't need that. What you needed was a continuity of mindfulness, you know, past that certain initial development, all of which may not be meaningful to you, but sociologically it had a big consequence, because up until the turn of the 20th century, there was, in many schools, probably most, if not all, there was a strong belief you had to achieve these states of concentration before you could develop insight and therefore liberation. And because they believe it's a rare accomplishment, it's not that easy to do, that usually meant only monks, because there were no nuns by then in Theravada Buddhism, and lay people were too busy, were too scattered, you know. We don't have the time to really just devote ourselves to that kind of practice. And then Mahasi Saito, who was my teacher's teacher, and a few other people, came around and said, no, that's not so. You don't need that kind of rarefied form of concentration. You just need some. And that had the consequence of opening up the practice to women, to lay people. So like if I was practicing in Burma at his monastery, which I did, it could be 4,000 lay people practicing at the same time. You know, and so it's sort of like saying liberation is a possibility for anybody, because liberation is based on insight, and insight is based on not concentration, but that kind of wider perspective. So it's actually historically a very important question. Okay, we're going to have to stop, and you have some more announcements.